Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Leila Lateef.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Leila, we are talking Marvel's Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Triumph Against the Odds, True Story, The Swimmers, and secretly shot Iranian drama, No Bears. But before we get on to those, what else have you been watching this week, apart from your homework that I've set you?
I've been kind of catching up on some of the things that I've missed over the course of the year, you know, as it's kind of that end of year assessment time. So things like I watched The Outfit this week. I finally got around to watching The Wonder this week. A couple of other little bits, but yeah, mostly TV as per usual, because it kind of just plugs in the gaps in the day recently. So I've been binging Wednesday. Yeah. On Netflix, which is out shortly. I can't say what I think of it, but let's say I have some very strong feelings. And the new series of Dead to Me, which is finally back. I really, really like that show with the fabulous Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. And if it's been a kind of a while since the last one. I think it's been about 2.5 years. But if you remember, they kind of ended in what could have been maybe a near fatal car accident. But, you know, there's a third series. So spoiler alert, they survived. But yeah, lots of other exciting twists and turns in that one. I really like that show.
Yeah. I went to the BBFC to talk to them about, you know, their latest sort of decisions in borderline 12-15, 15-18 decisions, which was fascinating. I love talking to them about it and what various things trigger things to be 18 or from a 12 to a 12A, and looking at things very differently. We were looking at Minions, The Rise of Gru. Who knew that that would be a certification nightmare because of the levels of threat and peril? And Doctor Strange, Into the Multiverse of Madness, I think. The Multiverse of Madness, Madness of Multiverse, whatever that one is. And just the fact that Sam Raimi's horror sensibilities tipped that into a 12A rather than a 12, due to the sort of the quite strong imagery. So that was fascinating. And I'm now looking at films in a whole different light. But yes, shall we get on then to our first film of the week? It's long awaited. It's bittersweet. It's time to get your tissues ready and return to Wakanda.
We know what you whisper. They have lost their protector. Now is our time to strike. Show them who we are.
So this is Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Leila, I mean, obviously a lot has happened since the last film in real life and on screen. Set it up for us.
Yeah, so the last one I believe was 2018, even though it feels to me like so much longer than that ago, because we've gone through this like pandemic and, you know, all these terrible things that happened. And for me, the low light of the pandemic genuinely was the day where I found out Chadwick Boseman had passed away of colon cancer. And, you know, it was just absolutely devastating. And we were all sort of still tied up in our homes, not knowing what was going to happen. And that was like a really horrific loss. I mean, I've still not seen Ma Rainey's Black Bottom because I sort of need to exist knowing that there's one more Chadwick Boseman film out there that I, you know, at some point maybe be able to get to watch. But yeah, he passed right before they were about to shoot this film, which I would say is quite obvious when you watch it. So they had to really obviously massively retool exactly what this was going to be. I don't think a lot of people knew about his illness. And so I think it came to a real shock to, you know, the cast and crew and the production of this. They thankfully have not recast him. The film sort of begins with Shuri, his sister, who's the sort of science genius, trying to figure out a way to cure her brother who has a fatal illness and getting very close, but, you know, sort of not quite managing it. And she actually misses the opportunity to kind of be with him on his deathbed, which is, you know, awful. And then we skip forward about a year. I think it's almost exactly a year into the future, and everybody's still sort of dealing with their grief, but they're also dealing with the ramifications of what happened at the last Black Panther film, which is that kind of Wakanda revealed itself to be this, you know, Afrofuturistic superpower, and that they had this vibranium and all of this like advanced technology. So yeah, the sort of dual threads in it, I suppose, are the people of Wakanda and, you know, his mother, Nakia playing by Lupita Nyong'o, all of those people dealing with a bit of a power vacuum, but trying to like explore their grief through this journey and the loss of T'Challa. And then at the same time, there's a sort of character called Namor, who emerges from the depths and sort of could be an ally, but then is at odds with them in some way. And their sort of goal is similar in that they want to protect the vibranium and make sure that it's not put to ill use. But they sort of have very different philosophies as to how to do that.
Mm.
That sums it up.
Yes. Does it work for you?
I mean, there's certainly things that really work for me. I think there's been a lot of complaints about some of the Marvel films being a bit sludgy and ugly recently. And I think Ryan Coogler's does have a lot more colour, does have a lot more vibrancy. I think it's Ruth Carter who won an Oscar last time for doing the costumes. I think her work in this is even better this
beautiful
time. A lot of the it's yeah, stunning. See the funeral wear and all the like ceremonial stuff. It's absolutely incredible. I'll be happy to see her hopefully get another one for this one. And it's weird. The Namor stuff doesn't particularly work for me because I think we've often talked about like a bit of a villain problem in the superhero films where it's just like, oh, they don't have compelling enough villains, something like the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's like, oh, we're so excited by those guys, but like, do we actually care about this villain? Mm. And I think the solution to that came because for me, Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger was the best villain of the MCU, basically. And it's a bit Professor X Magneto that's just actually got pretty convincing ideas a lot of the time, and you're yeah, not entirely sure like who is bad. And it's kind of like you know, you give somebody quite like strongly held beliefs and then you're kind of debating who is the bad guy. And I think they're trying to do that again with this one, but it just doesn't work. He's no Killmonger. And I also don't think we quite have the action sequences a bit like, you know, the casino one in the last one that like really compares. But I miss Chadwick Boseman, and, you know, in this film, I miss T'Challa desperately, and like all of the characters do as well. And they're constantly acknowledging that, and that kind of, this is a void that can't be filled. And, you know, that's fitting because he's not an actor that you can really replace or a screen presence that you can replace. But then you are still left with a film with a void in it. It's a nice tribute that you like want him back so much, but then also they can't compensate for him not being there.
Yeah. I mean, they do try very hard. I mean, the Marvel logo at the beginning is all Boseman. We get sort of, as an audience, a sending off, as you mentioned, this funeral, which brought a tear to my eye, just the soaring score and like the pictures of him on the walls and the ceremony. And it was beautiful. But then he does crop up in sort of people's interior worlds when they think about him. And he's a huge presence over the whole of this. But I kind of really like that element of it. For me, this is a film that's two different films smushed together. And it's mm-hmm. the film that was going to be before he died, and then the film that now comes into being, but they don't actually marry up together. So the grief for me works really well, and the exploration of grief and the stages of grief that Shuri goes through, the rage and all of those things that we know, the seven stages of grief, and all tied up in sort of the geopolitics of it, and the fact that, you know, now that he's gone, Wakanda is vulnerable and that people have their eyes on their prizes. That works for me. And the idea of a matriarchal society being just entirely led by women is thrilling. But then this Aquaman 2.0 in the man from the ocean with, you know, a lovely set of swimming trunks and wings on his ankles and CGI whales and fish everywhere. The CGI wasn't brilliant. I didn't think the action sequences sang. And yeah, those two things, I couldn't marry up at all. I was like, I just prefer to concentrate on one or the other and do that justice rather than trying to slam two films into a 2 hour plus running time and not quite succeeding with either.
Yeah, no, I do tend to agree. I mean, it is something that I've got higher hopes for when it comes to Avatar, that they're going to nail that underwater world a bit more. And obviously, like, you know, James Cameron basically made everybody become free drivers for that. It ends up being a bit jarring when you've got kind of like not 100% CGI against like terrible sadness. Whilst in like Aquaman, I didn't mind it so much because it was just like, oh, this is more like campy fun. I quite like it.
Yeah, Aquaman. And you've got an octopus playing bongos. Like, you know, we could have done with that here, maybe. I don't know. It just feels like it's stuck between two stools.
Did you also find the wings on the ankles really annoying somehow?
How's he flying with such tiny wings? They were like a sparrow wing.
But like, he's also magic.
I assume there's more going on. I don't know my Marvel canon of that character brilliantly well. So I'm assuming there's more going on than just the wings for the flight. But yeah, it was kind of ridiculous, wasn't it? When he came up with the little, they're like flapping away like a trapped bird. I don't know. There was something really ridiculous about it and I couldn't take it seriously. And then, especially when it's counterpointed with this extreme serious sort of level of storytelling about, you know, how do you get over somebody that was such a huge person in your life romantically, as a figurehead, as a mentor, as a brother? How do, as a society, how as a family, how as a lover, how as a sister, do you get over that? And do you, or do you channel that grief into something more positive? There is obviously no spoilers, but there is a moment that is sort of intended for the audience to cheer. Did it do it for you?
No, felt a bit cheap, if I'm honest. You know, it's hard because obviously I think the last thing Chadwick Boseman would want in the world was this thing to not continue without him. And with obviously T'Challa, the character, the last thing he'd want in the world was for Wakanda to continue without him. But yeah, some of the sort of, I suppose, franchise building or continuing just felt a bit cheap, given the context. But it's a tough one. I kind of feel that maybe Ryan Coogler had an impossible task here.
Yeah.
And maybe this is about what you can do, because, you know, people don't want to go into the next MCU film and just kind of sit there weeping for 2.5 hours. I appreciate that, but and maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just what I wanted to do. I wanted to sit and kind of contemplate on the nature of mortality and just be really sad. Yeah, I don't think tonally it came together. But I would say I was quite disappointed because one of the Black Panther stories that I did read not too long ago was the Roxane Gay one, which is kind of a beautiful love story between two of the female warriors. And Michaela Cole's character is in that and she's so brilliant in it. And obviously Michaela Cole is a wonderful actress and truly one of our like top 10 faces of humanity. And I was disappointed that she didn't get that much to do.
She felt a little bit like, you know, Ironheart being introduced for the show that's going to hit Disney Plus later, that they're sort of in there because they have to be, but we're not really going to do much with them. And that was a little bit frustrating for me.
I would say I did slightly miss the absence of Daniel Kaluuya as well. It would have been nice for him to come back. I'm not really sure where they're going to go from here. They certainly do set up a few possibilities.
You do have a Black Panther at the end of it.
We do.
And other promises, shall we say. Does it fill you with hope for where Black Panther may go? I mean, the first film was such a seismic thing, such an event, and so different, and so much representation on screen, and so much power. It obviously is an incredibly hard act to follow. This, I think, maybe hasn't managed quite as well, but does it give you hope for where we might go with this?
Yeah, it's strange because my instinct is that we need to take a decade off and then kind of come back when we've sort of moved on in certain ways. I think as much as there was a good gap between the last one and this one, you know, with Chadwick Boseman's passing, I think it would be appropriate for us to kind of really regroup and then kind of take this in a completely different direction, not to spoil what they do set up in the next one. But yeah, I think just sort of hammering forward would be weird. But I'll be interested for Ironheart. She's a charismatic actress. But yeah, this felt like a farewell. Or at least the elements of this that felt the best for me felt like a farewell.
Yeah, that there was closure on something that had begun. And it's quite strange as well, watching something that as a, you know, an audience you've actually felt in real life, it hasn't just happened on screen. The loss of Boseman did happen to everyone in real life. And also if you're watching this having gone through the pandemic and you've lost somebody who you couldn't save and you really wanted to and you couldn't get to their bedside, there's a lot of sort of evocation of that as well. So in some ways, I think it's probably a very healing kind of therapeutic film for a lot of people. But if you're wanting your wham, bam, thank you, ma'am action, you're maybe not getting it here.
Yeah, I got to say, that is something that I love when TV and films do that. Like, I thought, surprisingly, I was a bit nervous for The Fast and the Furious when Paul Walker passed away, of like how they were going to do it. And I actually thought it was really lovely. Gilmore Girls, I was a big fan of. And then when they came back for the resurgence, you know, the guy who played the patriarch, who's also in The Lost Boys, he passed away and they had his funeral. And I think that is actually really nice to do, to have a moment of like, we as the cast and crew are in mourning, and we are going, you as an audience are as well, and let's sort of just break down almost the fourth wall and all just be sad together.
Yeah. And I think if you want to do that, then Black Panther does give you that. It does give you that opportunity to grieve. We're not saying it's a duff. It's worth seeing, but maybe measure your expectation, lower it slightly.
Lower your expectation and bring some tissues.
Indeed. Okay. So if you want to see Black Panther, it is out in cinemas from Friday. We're going to stay in the water then with our next film. It's this.
The Olympics feel so far away right now.
I believe you can do it. I'm invincible.
We need to get to Germany.
You're not allowed to give up. I'm so
powerful. I heard you both had to escape a war. We're forming an Olympic refugee team for real.
We have a lot of work to do.
You should do it. You're so much more than an Olympian.
Ready?
So this is The Swimmers, the true story of two girls who were refugees and became an Olympic swimmer. It's a triumph over adversity. What else is going on though, Layla?
So it comes from Saral Husseini, who is an Egyptian-English director. She did a film called My Brother the Devil that was kind of quite, it was brilliant and like quite harrowing. This is a much sort of sweeter film, I suppose, more inspiring and a bit more kind of Disney, I guess, in a way. It's the story, the real life story of two swimmer sisters who the war in Syria rages on and they've got to flee Damascus and they're kind of making this journey to Europe. And as so many people do, they end up on a very small overloaded boat in the Mediterranean, trying to get to Greece, which is taking on water. And the film sort of exists for that scene where they sort of, in a moment of like incredible bravery, jump out and like swim with this boat, kind of tugging it during, you know, not quite rough seas and get everybody safely there. And as we know, so many people drown on that journey. And it's kind of one of those things that's almost too difficult to think about because it's so horrible, and it's so horrible that it happens so often. Years and Years did a very harrowing depiction of that on TV a few years ago, but I digress. So yeah, it's a sort of inspirational story of these two young swimmers. It's a great act of heroism, and then a journey to the Rio Olympics for one of them. It's based in reality, and yeah, I don't even know what to really much to say about it. It's so pedestrian. It's got such good intentions. And, you know, in a world where you have people saying, like, I think recently the immigrants were described as an invasion and, you know, very dehumanizing stuff. So I think it's good that there's this is out there as a piece of cinema, you know, pretty meh.
Yes, this is a Netflix film, and it will be a limited cinema release this week and then on Netflix later in the month, which always denotes an ambition and an appetite for awards. But yes, it's a very tricky film because it's weirdly teeny and sort of glossy in a way, and sanitized strangely. Apart from those particular scenes you're talking about in the inflatable, the rest of it, you know, like Sia music plays all the time at very strange moments, that it really is trying to lift you up. It's really trying to make you say, this is like inspiring. And it's almost like the soundtrack alone is like, this is inspiring, be inspired. But it's not. It's over 2 hours long. It has a little Rocky training montage. It feels very sort of explanation for people who are not aware of this. It's definitely aimed at people who don't really have a concept of this as a thing, of people desperately trying to escape awful situations and being trafficked. And, you know, at one point someone says, I've paid $1,000 for this, US dollars for this, just so that anyone in America understands the cost that's involved to these people. It felt very like Refugees for Idiots. for me. And I really liked everything it was trying to do. It felt like it was coming from a really good place, and really, you know, I wanted to really like it. I wanted to be really inspired. But actually, the story itself is very inspiring, but the film isn't.
I know what you mean. It's maybe we're just not the audience for it, because we kind of do view refugees as humans. So we didn't need to have that message kind of hammered home. You know, it's almost like the film is sort of geared towards people that are just like, you know, it would be a bad thing if these people drowned. And it's, you know,
yes.
I was already on that page.
And the, you know, she does quite a very good job of sort of setting up their life in Damascus as being very sort of brightly coloured and full of fun, and like full of pool parties and disco dancing and fun and joy. It really feels like it's for people who just consider all of that region just to be, you know, desert and bombs and misery, and have no concept of all of these places that before there was war, they were vibrant communities and doing all the same things that, you know, anyone in America or the UK or Europe is doing. Just, you know, that idea feels really overly wrought in this, as though people are not aware of that. So, yeah, it does feel strangely preachy.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the young actresses were pretty good.
Real life sisters.
Okay, well, maybe that chemistry is less impressive if they're real life sisters.
Oh, but she's so mean today.
It's very heavy-handed dialogue. There's only so much they could do with it. But yeah, they were certainly very charming and charismatic. And, you know, I hope everybody in this goes on to do some other stuff. And if maybe this changes the minds of a couple of people. It's message first rather than film first.
Right. And do you think that it has a chance in the awards season?
No. Not
in
really.
A word?
Yeah, well, I wonder whether, you know, particularly given that like awards season tends to be a lot of champagne socialists. So, I mean, I don't know that they'll be that kind of blown away by this, since I imagine they'll be pretty in tune with the plight of refugees crossing the sea. But I mean, who knows? I'm frequently surprised. As I've said many times on this podcast, did not see Coda as best picture coming.
No, and that's, you know, quite a similar little sweet and glossy version of a world that perhaps not many people are aware of, or some people are not aware of. So it might be something that does, you know, take the fancy of the Academy, but there's better films about this subject out there.
Yeah, and I think also if we're talking international Oscars, there's some really good ones this year. I've got all my money on Saint Omer to get it in the end, so I don't really think this sort of compares to that, or even to something like No Bears, which I suppose is a contender for that award.
Indeed.
Which we'll be talking about soon.
Yeah. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of The Swimmers, it is out in cinemas this Friday, and then it hits Netflix on the 23rd of November. Okay, so before we move on to that film that Layla mentioned earlier, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, The Last Picture Show. This is a serial podcast where we ask different people in different fields what they would put on at the cinema if they had one last night to do it. What four films would they put on and why? We have had a lot of directors, Baz Luhrmann, Joe Wright, various people. And this week we've had Amy Lou Wood from Sex Education giving us her four films. Please do look it up. She's chosen some quite interesting movies, and I'm with her. I'd like to see her selection. So please try looking for it on your podcast platform by searching for Total Films Last Picture Show.
I can remember the first films that I watched at home.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember watching E.T. and thinking that it was the best thing to ever happen, ever. I just was obsessed. I watched E.T. and then I had, you know, for Christmas, I got an E.T. teddy bear. I was just E.T. mad. It just was so, it captured my imagination so much. And I just remember sitting watching it and the music just giving me goosebumps.
So it's time for our final film now. Let's go to this.
شما تو این روستا عکس گرفتی
عکس ازتون خواستم آقای مهندس این عکس ده ما رو ریخته به هم این ماجرا همه ما رو پلت کرده
آخ بیل بردا بلیت دانه میشه ماهانا دالیز جز نشد
آقای مهندس یورزن ارکان دوشه سلام آقای مهندس
Okay, so this is No Bears, which Layla and I both saw at Venice Film Festival. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it was so sad that the Venice Film Festival, I saw this, I wasn't at the press conference, but I saw this image of, they did actually have a seat for Jafar Panahi at the press conference to kind of acknowledge that he wasn't there. But yeah, he's a sort of very highly regarded Iranian filmmaker. He's had a lot of films and a lot of prizes at Venice in the past. Iranian cinema is one of those weird things where they've got such an incredible culture of cinema, and it seems no matter how oppressive the government gets, they are still able to kind of create like world-class films. So he sort of lived a lot of his life in the past decades under like various forms of like house arrest. And then he, I believe it was about a year ago or quite recently, went to go to protest the fact that there were two filmmakers that had been locked up, and then he's been sort of held in prison ever since. So this film comes out in a very sad time for Iranian cinema that they, one of their great masters is currently in prison. But yeah, he's a sort of quite mischievous person, I suppose, in many ways. Because one of his last films, after they banned him from making films in 2010, was called This Is Not a Film. And I believe he's had one that he snuck out of Iran on like USBs hidden in cakes.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he's an incredible sort of renegade filmmaker, isn't he? In terms of, and his urge to create films, regardless of the sort of personal cost to himself, is quite incredible. And this film sort of reflects himself in as much as he's sort of playing a heightened version of himself in a film that does touch on all of those things that he's currently sort of experiencing. Tell us a little bit about what the film is actually about.
Well, the sort of film is almost about that situation, because it's it sort of starts with quite a like melodramatic scene in like a Turkish market with kind of two lovers who are fighting because they want to flee, and then one of them is managed to get the passport and the other one had, and will you leave without me, and all a bit kind of not quite the sort of more subtle stuff that Panahi's better known for. But then it sort of cuts away and you realize that this is sort of a film within a film. And he's actually just over the border in Iran, kind of directing through like very dodgy phone Wi-Fi, trying to kind of tell the people in Turkey what to do. And that's the sort of workarounds he has to do in order to get his film films made. Yeah, there's sort of several layers to it. There's a film within the film. There's the struggle of Jafar Panahi, who's playing himself, to kind of direct it. They're sort of slightly commenting on, you know, the difficulties around it and alluding to all of that. Because he has to be so close to the border, he's in this very provincial little village. Even though everybody's Iranian, they're very different. He's obviously a very worldly, sophisticated man, and these people are much more traditional. So those things clash as well. So yeah, it's a lot of layers upon layers upon layers. Without the backstory, it would just seem like a complete mess. But if you are invested in his journey and his struggles as a film director, it's very interesting from that perspective.
Yes, I think you do need to have that context in order to really understand the film and get the film. And the ideas of borders that come up with it, there's a point where he steps over a border and back again, and he doesn't know where the border is of Iran, and he knows that he can't go out of it, so he's terrified. But it's literally just dirt, and it's one step either way that's either in or out of Iran. And that idea that his art is a bit like that he's just very tiptoeing along the edge of what he can acceptably get away with without landing in prison. But obviously that has happened since he's made this film. So it's very bittersweet to watch it and to see him sort of tooling around this village and sort of bumbling about. It's a bit bumbling, isn't he, in this film, in a sort of nice way. We're watching him do that within the confines of what he has to work with, but that now we know that he's sitting in a cell. That is very bittersweet to watch.
And his son, Panah Panahi, which, what a fantastic name, made a kind of film with a similar themes earlier this year called Hit the Road, which was also exploring the idea of borders and family and
which
identity
was cracking.
In Iran. It was so good. So it is nice that his legacy is continuing in some way, but it's like there's so much this week, particularly with films, where I'm just like, I can't bring myself to think about it. It's so desperately sad. And like, the poor plight of Jafar Panahi, migrants crossing the Mediterranean, the loss of Chadwick Boseman. This has been an opening up of some very sad mental boxes for me.
I'm sorry about that. Yes, we should have been talking about Slumberland with Jason Momoa on Netflix, but no screenings were forthcoming, which doesn't bode well for it, does it?
No, I think that's rarely been a pleasant surprise. That did kind of happen with Tick, Tick, Boom last year. They were a bit reluctant, but I actually really liked that. I know you didn't, but pleasant surprise for me at least.
Yeah, yeah. So with this one, you mentioned this as a possible Oscar contender. Do you think that this is the sort of, I mean, this is very much the sort of thing that voters would go for in terms of a director who literally goes to prison for his art. Do you think the sort of real life backstory is what might push this over the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely a thing with the Oscars where it is fundamentally, would you kind of take a step back? Like, you're handing out shiny statuettes that don't really have much purpose beyond that. So I think if there's an opportunity, I mean, I'm a St. Omer devotee. I want to see that go all the way. But if they have a purpose of kind of getting what is happening to Jafar Panahi and many other less famous Iranian filmmakers onto a global stage, I think that would actually be quite a nice use of it.
Yes. Use your statuette wisely, Ampras.
That doesn't always lend to the best results in a way. Because you remember when Fahrenheit 9/11 won the Palme d'Or? I mean, yeah. It's like, actually, sometimes maybe the politics shouldn't be the sole motivator. But also as a kind of lifetime achievement award, it would make sense. Because this isn't my favourite film of his, but he's got a really great filmography. So
yeah, and if it opens up what he's done before to new viewers, maybe that is a good thing. But yeah, it is always tricky when awards are given out politically rather than artistically. And then the question is, what is the use of the award? Is it to do as you say, or is it to award great art? And I mean, the Oscars are not... we should talk about the Oscars as well. Jimmy Kimmel's going to be hosting, we've just heard. That we're going back to the old school methodology of one host and doling out the prizes as if things have never changed before. Do you like that idea?
I like that there's a host back, certainly. I think this is like one of the most boring choices imaginable for host. I know there's a lot of scheduling conflict stuff that really happens because apparently The Rock has expressed that he's up for it. Tom Holland has said that he'd be up for it. And obviously these people's schedules are absolutely crazy. And I don't think you really earn any money doing the Oscars. So you're sort of doing it from the goodness of your own heart. But if they're going to bring somebody back, it should have been Hugh Jackman, because that was a very underrated hosting stint. But yeah, I was really hoping it was going to be the Only Murders in the Building crew of like Steve Martin, Martin Short and Selena Gomez. International appeal people, you know, for the old people who love everybody loves Demani, but for the older generations that has appeal, younger people would show up to see Selena Gomez. Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, no, and also nobody outside of America really has a relationship with Jimmy Kimmel. He's not like a big international person.
He is a safe pair of hands, they would say. He has done it before. But yeah, I mean, their viewing figures have fallen off a cliff. They need to do something. So perhaps they'll make the actual ceremony the more engaging part of it. And he's just the steward to get us through those hours and hours in the middle of the night.
Maybe. I mean, growing up, the one that I always loved was when Billy Crystal did it, because he was able to do the musical numbers, doing the kind of witty bits, and he always sort of kept it funny without it ever getting too mean, and it still felt like a sincere, like, he loved cinema sort of thing. But yeah, Jimmy Kimmel, it's a bit snarky. It's a bit kind of, even like the stunts that he pulled in the last one, where he kind of got a load of like normal people to come in and like see the stars. Like, I always feel like Jimmy Kimmel basically thinks that if you aren't famous, you aren't fully human. A lot of his stuff is like taking a dig at like, look at these normies.
Yeah, that was awkward. And the sort of delight of them seeing stars was tempered with this idea of sort of creatures in a zoo, wasn't it? Like, bring in the creatures to look at, you know, like just quite weird. We've had a very strange and turbulent couple of years, and the ceremony needs to reflect that. And also, do we mention the slap? You know, like, what's going to go on with that?
I just got my invitation to an Emancipation screening, the new Will Smith for Apple TV, and I am just like, give him another Oscar, just that'll do your viewing figures some good.
I mean, people would absolutely tune in to see him turn up and be repentant or whatever he's going to do. If you're going to be cynical, awards bodies, that's the way to go. But we haven't seen that
make
film.
Jada Pinkett Smith host the Oscars.
I'd tune in for that too. Yeah, absolutely. It is a shame that it's another man.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand this kind of desire of the Academy to be like, we have to reinvent ourselves, and then so consistently making such boring choices, and then also in a way alienating people like myself who will just watch the Oscars no matter what. Like, taking away like the costume, taking away a load of the technical awards, those are some of the most fun moments of the whole night. I remember watching one where they did like a full fashion show. God, I'm showing my age, because this was definitely Men in Black was the first one was in that. And, you know, then you'd have Tyra Banks coming out in a big Renaissance thing, and there were big musical numbers set to like the full Monty. And like that, you know, that's actually where you really have an opportunity to like have some fun. I mean, otherwise you might as well just Google the results the next morning. Got to bring back the spectacle. Let's talk about special effects. Let's talk about costumes. Let's talk about all the stuff that they've gotten rid of.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there you go. If you want us, Oscars, we as consultants, we're ready for you. We have ideas. Layla has some ideas about numbers that she'd like to incorporate and various other bits. But we digress from No Bears. We will see if that does make the Oscars, but it is out in cinemas from Friday. Right, it's time for the Star Wars character war to continue. Last week, we had Han Solo versus Darth Vader, and Darth Vader won as the best character between the two of them. And Twitter agreed with us. 30.7% voted for Han against 69.3% for Darth Vader. So Vader is triumphant because he's so evil. Layla, who are you bringing into the ring to go up against old Buckethead?
Well, I'd just like to start with, this is incredibly unfair. If you started with Darth Vader, I was hoping for like, maybe I'd get like, who's better than like Sebulba from the prequels or something. Okay, but I do have a strong argument. The greatest Star Wars character, or at least the person that kind of symbolizes what the Star Wars needs more of, is Lando Calrissian. So Lando Calrissian appears in The Empire Strikes Back, and he is like an administrator of Cloud City. He's played by the incredibly cool Billy Dee Williams, somebody nobody's ever looked better in a mustache. And automatically what happens when we kind of come across his character and his, you know, place of Cloud City, is it opens up the universe, because we have somebody who we have like a real sense that has had a life and a long and adventurous life beforehand, and also has a different set of morals immediately, because he straight away betrays them, because it's like, oh, okay, it's all of the citizens of Cloud City, or it's you, my old friend Han, and this kind of small crew of people. It's not about kind of like the Force or anything spiritual. I just had to make like a fully utilitarian choice, and my loyalties will shift over time. And he's still a good man. He fights with them all. But it just is the antithesis of what annoys me, which Star Wars occasionally does, where they make this galaxy smaller and smaller and smaller by trying to make everybody related to one another. And what you need is more characters like Lando Calrissian, who are incredibly charismatic and cool, and they open up to like that there are other people out here with different systems of beliefs, different storied lives, different planets and ways of thinking. And that's something that we can revisit. And I think that is what has made recent shows like The Mandalorian and Andor so great, because they have followed that thing of like a Lando Calrissian, of having somebody that is not just in this like small family of people and making the galaxy, and a galaxy is a huge place, feel smaller and smaller and smaller. Also, has anyone ever looked better in a cape?
Elvis.
Oh.
Okay, so it's a tie.
I'm not going to say better, but equally rocking a cape. But yeah, no, you're right. The cape is magnificent, and he is magnificent in all of his forms, Donald Glover as well. But yeah, I've got to fight for Darth, because obviously, you know, you're saying he's sort of insignificant in terms of Darth. Darth is trying to take over the whole of the galaxy. Lando is just trying to like operate in his own set of circumstances. So for my money, as a whole, Vader is more important to this world. And so he has to beat him on that level, narratively and sort of from a story point of view.
But what are the stakes of this galaxy if we don't have our Lando Calrissians? Because essentially, like, when we have just Vader and it's kind of, you know, oh, it's him and his various relatives, like, it just makes it so much smaller. And it's like, oh, defeating Anakin versus kind of colonizing an entire galaxy seems to have the same weight as it. And when we don't have our Landos, it kind of means that all of this doesn't mean much more than a sort of dysfunctional family dynamic.
Just with blowing up stars and things, blowing up planets and things, that they just do that whilst they're having tiffs between them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it makes the blowing up the stars a metaphor for the family dynamics, and I think that the Lando Calrissians make it like more that this is a real galaxy and these are real people trying to live their lives. And sometimes they will flail because, you know, pressures come and they've got to make a decision between betraying their old friend and like saving all of the people. And then sometimes they'll rise to the occasion and they will go into battle and they will defeat the bad guy. And that is a very human stakes, which I think we need more of in the Star Wars universe.
This is a compelling argument, Layla. I'm struggling to argue against this, as this, you know, this is very satisfying. And in terms of Star Wars, if we want this to go on for longer, we do need to expand these worlds. Maybe Vader's had his time. I'm inclined to turn to your side, turn to the Calrissian side over
come
the dark
to the
side,
ambiguous side,
to the caped side. I mean, Vader wears a good cape too, but really, is it as jaunty as Calrissian's? Probably not.
No.
Okay, I think I'm going to say you can have him on this one, but obviously, Twitter makes the final decision. So go to Twitter and tell us. Is Vader the winner over Lando, or the other way around? Do we need more everyman in a wider universe, or do we need Buckethead just blowing shit up? Let us know. That will be on Twitter.
Lord Vader, what about Leia and the Wookiee?
They must never again leave this city.
That was never a condition of our agreement, nor was giving hand to this bounty hunter.
Perhaps you think you're being treated unfairly?
No.
Good. It would be unfortunate if I had to leave a garrison here.
So you've won. I think you should feel very pleased with your work today.
Yeah, that was not any against Darth Vader. I mean, come on.
That's very good.
Give me a Jar Jar Binks or something.
I know. Well, we will, I'm sure, get to him later. Okay, so I should remind you as well that if you enjoy this podcast, please do subscribe, because it makes it easier. It just pops there in your box, as it were. We just pop in there, and also it just makes us very, very happy people. But for now, this is all we've got time for. We do just have time for a listener's question, though, before we go. I mean, this is a difficult one for me to answer, and I don't know about you, but what's the greatest car in movies?
Well, I think I'm going to make Matt Mason quite happy, where I'm going to say that for me, it's the Christopher Nolan Batmobile, mm-hmm. because the Batmobile was like so intensely camp in all of its like original iterations, and I think it was quite difficult in that very serious Nolan Batman universe to be like, how are we gonna honor the Batmobile whilst also not make it seem like jarringly silly given how gritty everything is? And I think what he came up with of just this kind of like half tank, half car kind of convincing, well, not killing machine, but like just like a monster of a vehicle. It was just so incredibly cool.
You could imagine that on sort of desert maneuvers. You know, some of the vehicles we've sort of seen in various wars over the last few years. It felt like real tech, didn't it?
Yeah, but it still felt like the Batmobile somehow.
Yes, indeed. Well, black. Does it come in any other colour? Doesn't, just black. Good, that's an excellent one. I mean, I obviously you can't argue with the DeLorean, but I think I'm probably going to go with Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I like the sort of homemade aspect of it. It's got a bit of a boat in it, a bit of a fireplace, all sorts of stuff in there that Professor Potts has put in there. It flies, it floats, it does bang bang as you're driving it. It's got seats like a feather bed, you know, a fine four-fendered friend. I think that would be the one for me. And also, you know, just I like anything that might get a child catcher out to sort of dance around singing Lollipops All Free Today. So that would be my car of choice. I think it would be a bugger, though, because obviously in the British climate, it doesn't have a roof. It's going to be problematic. Mm. You're going to be fine in your Batmobile, aren't you? And I bet that parks itself.
Or weather terrain.
I think I'm going to struggle with Chitty. Like, I don't even know if it has wing mirrors. I might struggle getting that in a Tesco's car parking space. Doesn't have a boot really either, does it? Just a wicker basket. It's not very good, actually, is it? I should probably choose differently.
Safety-wise, not great. I didn't see seatbelts.
No seatbelts, no.
Which, given that there's no roof, that's really great.
And
given, you're flying.
And you're flying. Yeah, my health and safety on this one isn't good. I think I'll just use it for nice days in the sun, and I'll be over to yours for any sort of motorway driving for the Batmobile, if that's okay.
Good plan.
Okay. So on that note, I think we'll say goodbye. We will be back next week with more films, hopefully a bit more cheery ones and not all sort of bleak ones. But for now, say goodbye, Layla.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Bye.
Chitty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, what we'll do, near, far, in a motor car, oh, what a happy time we'll spend. Bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, our fine four-fendered friend. Bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, our fine four-fendered friend.
Chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang. Oh, you pretty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, we love you. And in chitty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, what we'll do, near, far, in our motor car, oh, what a happy time we'll spend. Bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang.